Welcome to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange, a weekly public affairs program helping you to ask questions, find answers, and distinguish the truth from the lie. I'm Kelly Romaris. We continue our series on the end of the age of oil with a look at changes to come. The end of the age of oil will have a profound impact on the United States, which has about 5% of the world's population. It consumes about 26% of the world's annual output of oil. What will the end of the age of oil mean to people used to jet travel, internet access, central heating and air conditioning, and foods imported from another hemisphere? Can any of these modern conveniences and more survive the inevitable change in energy regime that is dawning? Or do we return to the way things were at the beginning of the 20th century or earlier? What trade-offs do we make, and who decides what they will be? What practices of the past can and should be revived that would help us live more in harmony with the ecosystem? One person who is studying these questions is Professor Richard Heinberg, a member of the core faculty of New College of California, Santa Rosa, where he teaches courses on energy and society and culture, ecology, and sustainable community. He has lectured widely, appearing on national radio and television in 5 countries. For the last 10 years, he has been publishing a monthly essay called The Muse Letter. The Muse Letter's purpose is to offer a continuing critique of corporate capitalist industrial civilization and a revisioning of humanity's prospects for the next millennium. Subjects range from global economics to religion to the origin of humanity's antipathy toward nature. Heinberg has published 4 books, Memories and Visions of Paradise, Exploring the Universal Myth of a Lost Golden Age, Celebrate the Solstice, Honoring the Earth's Seasonal Rhythms Through Festival and Ceremony, A New Covenant with Nature, Notes on the End of Civilization and the Renewal of Culture, and Cloning the Buddha, The Moral Impact of Biotechnology. His 5th book, The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies, will be published in the spring of 2003 by New Society Publishers. On November 1, 2002, Heinberg spoke to Radio Internet Story Exchange by phone from his home in Santa Rosa, California, about possible scenarios for a society faced with the end of the age of oil.
We're moving into a new phase of global history, the wind-down phase of the Industrial Revolution. Up to this point, we've had more energy available per year, per capita, and that increase in available energy has been translated into new inventions, population growth, production of more food to feed more people, more transportation devices, faster transportation, more long-distance transportation of food and everything else. And we're just getting to the point where the global per capita production of energy is peaking. Oil production is about to peak. Other forms of energy are not far behind. And so for the next century, we're going to see sort of the mirror image of the 20th century, where instead of more energy being available each year and more inventions, more transportation, more of everything, we'll see somewhat less every year of all of those things that we've become accustomed to. And that's going to have huge lifestyle implications, not to mention political and economic implications. People will really need to learn how to live differently on the planet than they have been accustomed to, which is a good idea anyway. I mean, the fossil fuel era has been an ecological disaster in terms of endangered species and the pollution of the biosphere and global warming and so on. We've known for decades that we really ought to wean ourselves from fossil fuels because of all the horrific consequences they cause. But we're getting to the point where it's no longer just sort of a moral argument that we ought to reduce our energy usage. We're getting to the point where it's going to happen one way or another, whether we like it or not. And our only choice really will be how to make that transition.
Do you see things as going in a bell-shaped curve where we started out with a certain kind of lifestyle and technology and are heading back that way? Or maybe we're spiraling down but will not lose it all? I mean, I like indoor plumbing.
Yes, so do I. You know, I don't have a crystal ball. I think the way that we adjust is really up to us. In the worst case, if we refuse to make any deliberate adjustments, I think it's possible that the coming century could be catastrophic. And fullest sense of that term, I think it we could see the collapse of industrialism and of complex societies around the world. I don't think that has to happen. We could make that adjustment much more intelligently, but right now there are very few signs that that's happening. Perhaps when it becomes clear that the production of fossil fuels has peaked, then perhaps people will be more interested in making that kind of adjustment. The problem is, of course, that when we get to that point, when the peak has already happened, and that could happen within just a few years, it may be too late to implement the most intelligent kinds of responses. We just won't have the time and the energy to invest in the kinds of responses that we could have made if we had begun the process, say, 30 years ago.
Yes, and with my discussions with Colin Campbell and Dale Allen Pfeiffer, we've talked a lot about the pros and cons and shortcomings and promises of different alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't need to get into the technical things again this time, but there is one point that perhaps needs to be brought out again. And that is that the infrastructure that we have with hydrocarbons is not the same infrastructure we need for the alternatives. So we have to build that, right? And that takes time. And
that's right. It would probably take anywhere from 30 to 50 years to rebuild the energy infrastructure of our society. And I'm constantly meeting people who have great ideas for, you know, limitless energy sources, and if only we started today, well, of course, we could solve all the problems. Well, even if these alternative energy sources are capable of supplying as much net energy to society as fossil fuels, which is a huge question, the transition time is, as I said, a matter of decades. Now, Howard Odum, who just died about a month ago, he was a great ecologist and writer on energy issues. He studied alternative energy sources, everything from solar and wind to microhydro and hydrogen and all of the possibilities very, very carefully, about as thoroughly as anyone has done. And he concluded his last book titled A Prosperous Way Down by saying, although many energy substitutions and conservation measures are possible, none in sight now have the quantity and quality to substitute for the rich fossil fuels to support the high levels of structure and process of our current civilization. I think that summarizes it pretty well. And just today, November 1st, in Science magazine, there was an article urging the development of alternative energy sources, and in that article, the authors also say that there is no current alternative to fossil fuels that would maintain world economic growth while generating fewer environmental toxins, basically saying essentially the same thing. In other words, the alternatives are important. They need to be developed. I'm absolutely in favor of solar, wind, the whole panoply of alternatives. And at the same time, we have to have a realistic understanding of what they're capable of. Currently, photovoltaics, for example, supply something like 0.006% of total global energy supply. So to grow that from 0.006% to even, say, 10% would require huge investment in many, many years, probably decades of time. So we're really looking at a fundamental shift in the whole energy infrastructure of our society that will entail not just changing from fossil fuels to some other sources, but also learning to do without energy for many of the applications that we've found, learning how to operate our society on the basis of less energy per year.
And photovoltaics is the fancy word for solar, right?
That's right, yes.
Also, the striking thing, given where we live, and we are near wind farms in the Altamont Pass. Your comments in your book, The Party's Over, about what it would take to gear up wind to its full potential.
Right. Well, currently, wind supplies about 0.07% of total global energy use. Now, I think wind is actually probably going to be easier to scale up than solar, but still there are inherent limits as to the speed with which that process can go, and limits to the ultimate amount that we'll likely be able to derive from that source. In order to, again, produce something like 10% of the energy that we're currently using from wind would require an investment of literally hundreds of billions of dollars over many years. What we need to be doing, in fact, in order to accomplish this kind of energy transition, is to switch from spending something like $350 billion a year on the military and begin spending something like $350 billion a year on our energy infrastructure.
Hey, you will not get any argument from me on that. But it seems that maybe nowadays the purpose of the military is to try to capture and control the remaining hydrocarbon sources.
Unfortunately, that's exactly true. There's reason to think that there are echelons within the government that are perfectly aware of our energy situation. And rather than breaking the unpleasant news to the general public and possibly being recipients of the backlash, you know, why didn't you tell us sooner, and, you know, why do we have to scale back our expectations for our children's lifestyle and so on. Rather than doing that, they've decided simply to continue with business as usual and try to maintain our addiction to fossil fuels by simply capturing greater supply from the Middle East. And, of course, the current push toward war with Iraq is a keystone of that policy.
And it's also been pointed out by my colleague Ed Rippey especially, but other people as well, that the military itself needs oil. It's this perfect example of how you have to use energy to get more energy.
Absolutely.
And one of my concerns about the future is, as the oil is dwindling in supply, that the military then begins to openly compete with civilian economies for what's left.
Right. Yeah, I think this is most likely to be apparent first with air transport. The commercial airline industry is probably one of the most vulnerable industries from the standpoint of the coming energy decline. Currently, all jet airliners run on kerosene, which is jet fuel, and they have no real alternative. It's true that there's been some research on running jetliners on hydrogen, but basically all of the planes would have to be completely redesigned and a whole entire new fleet of jetliners built to run on hydrogen. In that case, of course, there's the problem of where do we get the hydrogen, which currently now 100% of commercially available hydrogen is made from fossil fuels, from natural gas. So as the peak in fossil fuel production occurs in the next few years, the already economically strapped airline industry will almost certainly be pushed over the brink. And instead of the airline industry being available for civilian use and that jet fuel going to civilian use, whatever is still available will almost certainly go to private aircraft for executives and other wealthy individuals, but overwhelmingly for the military.
No more Super Saver fares to the other coast.
Unfortunately, I think if you want to get in some sightseeing travel to the other side of the planet, the next couple of years is probably a good time to do that.
Well, you were saying about the levels of our power structures who know this is coming. I actually have in my hand the Strategic Energy Policy Challenges for the 21st Century.
Yes.
From the James Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice and the Council on Foreign Relations.
What an extraordinary document.
Yes, and I brought this up at a little talk I gave at a teach-in a few weeks ago, and the part of the document, I have not gotten through all 62 pages yet, but I will, that strikes me the most is this one sentence on page 3, that Americans face long-term situations such as frequent sporadic shortages of energy, energy price volatility, and higher energy prices is not the fault of President Bush. Now, I presented that sentence because it sounded to me like a campaign statement. It sounded to me like those things they're describing are not so long-term.
Right. Well, in fact, there's considerable accumulating evidence that we'll be seeing a natural gas shortfall here in North America beginning this winter. I have here in front of me something from Oil and Gas Journal that October 14th, 2002, it says a survey of 30 of the largest U.S. gas producers indicates that U.S. gas production, natural gas production, declined by 1% sequentially in the third quarter and likely will be down 6% for the year as a whole. Currently, we're importing about 16% of our natural gas from Canada, and unfortunately, Canada is in pretty much the same situation. Its natural gas production is just peaking now. I think that's going to be a rude shock for the American public, particularly during the wintertime when they want to stay warm, and it's inevitably going to have profound political repercussions as well, and I'm sure the Bush administration is even now looking for good excuses and for ways to distract the attention of the public so that people are paying more attention, say, to wars overseas or something like that than to the thermostat in their living room.
Yes, I find it even shocking that they are talking about, in commercials, setting your thermostat to 78 at home. I remember when it used to be 72. Mm. It was because normally I grew up, everybody expected to set it at 68. And then the first energy crisis hit in the 70s, and they said, oh, bump it up to 72.
Yeah, during the summertime, right.
And now they're talking about 78 and 85 when you leave home. Mm-hmm. So that may be a hint there through the corporate structure. But, yeah, let's talk about heating and cooling as one of the ways of getting into how the energy shortages will affect our lifestyles. You made a very good point in your book about how we take heating and cooling for granted and that it could actually be dangerous for people if we run out of the wrong kinds of fuel.
Right. Well, currently about 750 or so people die every year from extreme cold, and somewhat fewer than 400 die in a typical year from extreme heat. And, you know, together these figures are a little over 1,000, maybe 1,100 people dying from exposure to extreme cold or heat. This is more than the combined death tolls from hurricanes, floods, tornadoes, and lightning. But it's still a relatively small figure, given the fact that most people have central heating. And most people who live in very hot places, Phoenix, Arizona, or Los Angeles or someplace, have access to air conditioning. When that ceases to be the case, then I think we're going to begin to see a likelihood of much higher casualties from extreme cold and heat. And, of course, refrigeration also figures into this picture. Refrigeration mostly is from electricity, but then our electrical generating plants mostly run on fossil fuels, mostly coal.
The Iceman cometh again.
Yes.
Well, my mother talked about ice boxes.
Right.
Literally, the guy would come with a block of ice.
That's right, yeah. Well, there are many ways that people did things decades ago that our parents and grandparents did that are worth reviving. We become so dependent on all of these electronic gadgets, and I say that as one who's probably as dependent as anyone on my computer for writing, for getting information from around the world, and so on. And yet, I know full well that even no matter how useful and helpful this device is for me, that its days may be numbered.
No, don't tell me that.
Sorry to break it to you, Kellen.
Oh, no, seriously, there have got to be some choices made when we have to ration our energy more carefully as to what we do want to keep and what is going to fall by the wayside. So maybe agriculture does need to be local and we don't get kiwis from New Zealand, but I don't want to give up being able to email someone from New Zealand.
Right, right. Well, I agree with you totally, and I think it's possible we could have the kind of world you're envisioning, but it will take some strategizing. Computers, you know, are not only dependent on electricity, which again mostly comes from coal these days, but also they're mostly made from plastics. So I suppose if we could find a way of making our computers out of hemp.
Ceramics. I keep saying I can't quite picture a ceramic computer, but maybe I have to.
Yeah, well, it's worth some research dollars, I suppose.
Well, then there's another issue right there. Who makes the choices and how?
Yeah, that's really a huge question, and it's not a question that we can address intelligently until people have the information. Right now, virtually the entire public is being kept in the dark about this issue. We're still being told, oh, we have 50 years before we even have to think about energy shortages. And that's simply not true. The information is there if you want to look for it. We do live in a society where there's very little overt censorship. But instead of the censorship being overt, there's a kind of skewing of the public's attention in directions that are, for the most part, frivolous. Of course, there are many people in advertising and public relations corporations who are paid huge salaries to make sure that this happens, and politicians the same way. It's really in no one's interest, in no one's economic interest, short-term interest, to to convey this information about our energy future, and that's why it's not being conveyed. But until it is, there's no way that we can intelligently strategize together in some kind of democratic fashion. So on one hand, you have the problem just of the information getting out, and then on the other hand, of course, you have the democratic decision-making procedures, which unfortunately right now, in this country at least, are falling on very hard times for a number of reasons.
You are listening to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. I'm Kelia Ramirez. This is the fourth in our series on The End of the Age of Oil. Today's topic is Changes to Come, featuring Professor Richard Heinberg of New College of California, Santa Rosa.
Energy is the capacity to do work. If you talk to a physicist, that's how he or she will define the word energy, the capacity to do work. So if there's less energy available in an economy, less work will get done. That's the bottom line. And with less work getting done, there's less of goods and services to go around. And so over the long term, I see the energy decline as having pretty dire economic implications.
Which brings me to one of my favorite subjects, which is the linkage between resource distribution and what we call employment. Mm-hmm. It seems to me one of the biggest wastes of energy, now that I've been reading all of this, has been fashion of any kind of sort. Clothes that, you know, we have to wear something that looks different every season. Cars that could last us a decade that we get rid of after 3 years or 4 years.
Right.
Maybe people are holding on to the cars a little more now because they're so expensive to begin with. But I'm old enough to remember my grandfather, a perk of his job as a labor union officer was a new car every 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of we've got to keep consuming, especially we're given this in the United States, because by shopping, by buying things, we are keeping money circulating in the economy, so we are keeping people at work.
Right.
Folks are saying, even you are saying, we got to get rid of the automobile. It doesn't work in a low energy regime. But then what do we do with all the workers who are making them and then all of the people who depend on them spending their paychecks, et cetera?
Right. Well, theoretically, the lower energy regime could be a full employment regime because as we have had more energy available every year, mostly from fossil fuels over the last century and a half, that energy has been put to work in the machinery of production. And that's really the source of increased worker productivity that we have seen over the last 150 years. Every time you see an index of worker productivity and how that's increased, what that really means is that more product has been produced per worker hour, and the way that happens is not that people are working harder, it's that individual workers are controlling more energy in the production process. More energy is being used to make goods and services per worker. So as we enter a lower energy regime, that means that worker productivity will inevitably decrease, which means that it will take more people to get the same amount of work done. Now, again, theoretically, that could easily translate into a full employment economy. The trick is for the economy to respond to this transition rationally. And unfortunately, I don't think it's likely to, because the current economic system is built on the assumption of perpetual growth. And that's why we have the fashion. That's why we have the new car models every few years, so that people will throw away their old stuff and buy new stuff and keep more money circulating. Now, that economic growth engine, it's not just resulting from a set of beliefs that growth is good. It's not just resulting from greed on the part of the people at the top of the economic pyramid, although that's certainly a factor. But it's built into the very structure of the system itself by way of the way money is created through the making of loans. It's through compound interest. If everyone in the world were to try to pay back all of their loans at once, there wouldn't be enough money in the world to do it with. Because the money to pay back those loans and the interest on them has to come from the creating of new loans. Literally, the way money is created is through the making of loans. And the only way that happens is with the expectation of more economic activity, manufacturers borrowing money to build new plants and so on. So in a regime where there is energy contraction from year to year, energy decline, there will be very little incentive to borrow money toward the creation of new production facilities. So the economy will begin to contract. So even though there could potentially be work for everyone, it's entirely possible that the economy as a whole could go into some kind of convulsive response like the Great Depression of the 30s, where in that situation there was, you know, there were still just as many people around, still as many mouths to feed, all the factories were still there and everything, but the economic system itself was so dysfunctional, so disrupted that the demand couldn't be matched with the supply and the labor force. I think something similar is extremely likely to happen in this case.
So just as we have to change our entire energy infrastructure on a physical level, we really are going to have to change our economic infrastructure, our whole financial infrastructure.
Absolutely, and our political infrastructure too, because in order for us to be able to make decisions about how to change the economic system and how to change the energy infrastructure, we're going to have a political system that can respond to these challenges. And unfortunately, our current political system responds primarily to campaign donations from huge corporations. We have a political leadership that's really incapable even of understanding the problem, much less responding to it rationally. And it's like the generals always prepared to fight the previous war. We have politicians who are completely unable even to comprehend the nature of what's approaching us.
Talk about energy slaves. What does a barrel of oil do for us?
Yeah, well, a barrel of oil has a tremendous amount of energy chemically embodied in it. And if that energy were equated with the amount of energy that the average human being puts out in working all day, 8 hours a day, and if you were paying that human laborer $15 an hour for her or his labor, the amount of energy embodied in that barrel of oil would represent about $45,000 worth of labor. And that barrel of oil currently goes for about $30 on the international market. So you can see this fossil energy that we've become addicted to, it's a huge, huge boon. It's easy to understand why we've become addicted to it. It's like free money. It was deposited there tens of millions of years ago by nature, and it's as though, you know, we have this bank account that was left to us by a rich uncle, and we've just been drawing down from that bank account. And unfortunately, we haven't thought about what we're going to do when all the money's gone or when all of the oil is gone, in the analogy.
Let me get back to the car.
Yeah, sure.
I haven't owned one in over a decade, but I keep saying to myself, gosh,
good for you.
No. No. Let's start, first of all, with your own car. You drive a biodiesel. Let's talk about that.
Right, right.
How did you get that? What is biodiesel?
Well, what my car is, it's a 22-year-old Mercedes, not the top of the line. It's one of the cheaper ones. And it's a Mercedes diesel. And I buy biodiesel, which is a fuel made from vegetable oil, from a supplier up in Ukiah in Mendocino County, and he's kind enough to drive down here to Santa Rosa a couple of times a month to make deliveries, and a friend and I have a couple of 55-gallon drums, and he fills them up, and then we fill up our cars from those. So currently I'm driving without contributing directly, at least, to U.S. Middle East foreign policy, and it's great stuff. I like biodiesel a lot. It smells a lot nicer than petroleum diesel. It's more expensive, unfortunately, and the car doesn't get quite as good gas mileage, but it runs perfectly well. And I think it's a kind of a boutique fuel that's becoming more and more popular. I'm seeing more and more little running on biodiesel stickers in diesel car windows every day.
And I think that's a great idea. And here's why I would love to have a car again.
Mm-hmm.
Time, by nature, is also a non-renewable resource.
Yeah.
And I keep saying, gosh, if I could have all the time I've spent waiting for public transit tacked on to the end of my normal life expectancy, I'd probably live to be at least 110.
Yeah, well, I wish we had public transit here in Santa Rosa. There are a few city buses, but it's not terribly easy to get around. And I have to say, hydrogen fuel cells and electric cars and hybrid cars. They're all good ideas. I'm glad I have my biodiesel car. I think it's great, people who can afford these things. And so, although, you know, this car only cost me like $3,000, so it's not like I had to put a second mortgage on the house to get it. They're great alternatives, but for the country as a whole, it's unrealistic to think that we're going to be able to run our national fleet of a little over 100 million, 120 million cars on these alternative fuels. Oh, take biodiesel, for example. The net energy from biodiesel is very low. In other words, in order to get that vegetable oil, you have to grow, say, soybeans or coconuts or something else to get the oil from. And with the fossil fuel inputs and the transportation and the processing that it takes to get that vegetable oil to the biodiesel plant, you've already used as much or more energy than the biodiesel will ultimately have when you burn it. So that's why I call it a boutique fuel. I think it's great for those who want to get into it, but it's not a solution to our national problem.
And that leads into another question, which is agriculture.
Yeah.
Lots of energy going into that. We're not going to be able to keep up that kind of agriculture anymore.
Yeah, and this is probably the biggest problem that we face as a species right now. We have created a form of food production, industrial agriculture, that is dependent on fossil fuel inputs at every stage of the process. From transportation of seeds and distribution of seeds, and now, horrifically, more and more genetically engineered seeds, to the inputs of chemical fertilizers, ammonia fertilizers, almost all made from natural gas currently through the Haber-Bosch synthesis process, to chemical insecticides and herbicides, again, almost all made from petroleum byproducts, the harvesting and transportation of the food. The typical American meal these days, the food has traveled 1,300 miles before it gets to our plates. At each stage of that process, we are dependent and increasingly dependent on fossil fuels. The problem with this globalization of the food supply is not just dependency, but also the fact that as we have created this current food system, we have cannibalized and destroyed the previous locally based, non-chemically dependent food system. So it's not as though we can just fall back on the small farmers, you know, living locally, who can supply all of our food needs. All of those local farmers are gone. Back at the turn of the century, 70% of the American population was still rural. There were still millions and millions of farmers. These days, well, I think in the year 2000 census, there wasn't even a category, there wasn't even a box you could check off for full-time farmer, because there were so few of them left in the U.S. The only way that kind of food system works, where the entire population is dependent on just a very, very few people, is if those few people are using giant machines and burning tons of fossil fuel in order to produce and transport food. When those fossil fuels go away, we'll have to find another way to feed ourselves. Ultimately, we're all going to be eating organic food. The question is how we're going to get there. And once again, some planning, some foresight, and some strategizing could make the transition much, much easier than will be the case otherwise.
Well, here's another issue. You've spoken to me of the gardening skills of your wife, mm-hmm. but that presupposes access to land.
That's right.
We know about the Brazilian landless peasants movement, but right here in our own country, the ex-mayor of New York, Rudy Giuliani, seemed constantly at war with community gardeners in New York.
Right.
My first question is, how productive can organic gardening and organic farming be compared to the industrial style? And then how can we grow enough food for ourselves if we don't have access to land? How do we get access to land?
Right. Well, first of all, the productivity question. In many situations, organic and ecological agriculture can be as productive, or in some situations even more productive, than industrial fossil fuel agriculture. However, looking at the situation globally, it's unlikely that we could make a transition to organic and ecological agriculture over the short term that would not entail a serious disruption of the human food supply. We're having trouble right now growing enough food for all the people in the world. We have had historically food surpluses, and those have contributed, in fact, to population growth. But the World Food Program, for example, issued a report on October 28th, just a couple of days ago, said, although emergency food aid almost tripled over the 1990s, it was not enough to meet growing needs. Population still increasing. This year, the World Food Program had to suspend help to 3 million women, children, and elderly people in North Korea because it had run out of resources. The spokesman said the global emergency relief system is overwhelmed.
Excuse me, but isn't that because the governments are not giving enough money to these programs?
There's that problem, but also global food production increases have stalled, and we're actually seeing a reduction in the amount of grain being grown and harvested each year. This is unprecedented. We haven't seen this before. We're actually getting to the limits of the amount of food that can be produced by our industrial agricultural system. And the transition back to a locally based organic food production system is bound to be traumatic. So, of course, this then shifts the topic over to population.
You are listening to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. I'm Kelia Ramirez. We now return to Professor Richard Heinberg on the end of the age of oil, changes to come.
There are populations in places where the land is not arable.
That's right. That's right. And we may, in fact, have already overshot the Earth's ultimate carrying capacity for human beings. And the carrying capacity for Earth absent fossil fuels may be, well, perhaps somewhere in the region of 2 billion humans, according to some estimates. At least that's what the population was a century ago before we became dependent on fossil fuels for agriculture. So the difference between the 6.2 billion we have now and the 2 billion that may be the sustainable long-term carrying capacity for humans is the number that we need to probably reduce our population by over the next century. Theoretically, that can be done if each couple were limited to one child over the next century. But then, of course, we have a horrific political problem of finding a way to humanely reduce population. It's not an easy task by any means, and of course it's fraught with controversy at every level.
And it's particularly fraught for those of us who are women. I believe a study was done a number of years ago that says there's about 100 million women missing on the planet, given birth rates, population distributions, etc. I saw a documentary a number of years ago, quite frank, about girl infanticide in India,
right,
where the culture is, you know, we can only sustain so many children in the family, and we can't keep all the girls we birth. China's one-child policy, coupled with their cultural norms, has led to the possibility that by the year 2020, there'll be 10 million unmarriageable men in China,
right,
because there aren't enough women. Their culture says that the son takes care of the parents in their old age, and the daughter takes care of her husband's parents. So everybody wants a boy to take care of them in their old age.
Right.
Then how do we get rid of the population? Do the 10 million unmarriageable men in China then end up being expended in a war?
Right. Yeah, see, this is something that that we as a species have not found a good way of dealing with yet. And it's something that we need to be turning our humane creativity toward, this question of how to maintain our numbers within the ecological carrying capacity of our environments. If we are, in fact, an intelligent species with the ability to overcome mere genetic programming, well, this is the way to prove it. Because otherwise, unfortunately, I'm afraid that population control will happen through the tried and true means of famine, pestilence, and war, which is not the outcome that any of us would want to see.
Towards the end of your book, there are some things here. Here's one I got. Saving seed is a time-honored traditional craft.
Right.
We are up against this intellectual property regime where they're suing people who are accidentally growing the genetically modified stuff that blew over to their farmland. We've got people pushing organic farming, but we've got these other corporations that are trying to create Terminator seeds that will only grow for one generation, and you have to use their chemical inputs.
Right,
right now, they seem to have more of the economic clout. The guy up in Canada lost the case.
That's right. Well, his case is going to the Canadian Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a better outcome there. But you're absolutely right. The Monsantos of this world have tremendous economic clout and therefore political clout. Nevertheless, I think it's important for those of us who have some understanding of what's coming down the pipeline to take advantage of the skills and resources that are still present before those are completely cannibalized by the corporate industrial system, which is really only going to persist for another few decades, and then we'll be left back with whatever resources we've been able to salvage. So let's salvage those resources now before they're gone. And one of those resources is seeds, the seeds of open-pollinated heirloom varieties particularly. We should be growing those in our backyards and saving them and trading them. I think this is one of the most important forms of political activism, the retention and the cultivation of these important skills. Also, skills around what's called primitive technology. I'm not an expert in this area myself, but going to some workshops with people who are expert in making string out of wild plant material and making bows and arrows and stone implements, essentially the way our ancestors were doing 10,000 years ago. It sounds bizarre to those of us who live in an urban environment that anybody would even want to be doing such a thing, but it's amazing how empowering, personally empowering, that kind of knowledge is. You know, one thing that living in industrial society has done for us is to disempower us at really fundamental, almost biological levels. How many of us really know how to survive in the wilderness? How many of us know how to feed and clothe and house ourselves absent the industrial system? And because we're so dependent on that system, therefore we tend to look the other way when that system does things that we would otherwise find morally repugnant, like destroying indigenous societies around the world or polluting the natural world or resulting in the extinction of innumerable species. We look the other way because we know we're dependent on that system, and if that system were to go, we would go. Well, we're going to have to find ways of weaning ourselves personally from that system, and cultivating those kinds of basic life support skills, I think, is part of that. I'm not advocating survivalism. You know, we should all go out and get shotguns or even bows and arrows and defend the backyard vegetable patch from possible marauders. I think we need to be considering how we can revitalize our local communities as well and create community food reliance and food security, support our local economies, and create, for example, public power co-ops that are based on renewable energies. It's going to be at the local level where the real survival and revitalization of culture is going to happen. We need to be working at a national level on policy issues, absolutely, but that's not the only level. We also need to be working at the level of our own homes and families and at the community level as well.
Colin Campbell ventured the thought that in this future that local communities and perhaps even the individual states in the United States would become more important. Do you think large countries like the U.S. or Canada or Russia can even sustain themselves as political structures in a low-energy world?
Ultimately, no. In a world without fossil fuels, I doubt that large political entities like the United States will be able to maintain themselves. And I think that's probably a good thing. It seems to me that democracy flourishes at the local level and perishes when the scale becomes so large that the individual voice is completely lost. Who knows how that transition will shake out. I think probably we need to be reinventing our political systems from the ground up anyway. The national machinery of government has become so ossified and fossilized that virtually no good can come from it these days anyway. So as far as I'm concerned, the sooner it runs out of gas and grinds to a halt, the better. But I think that there are many people who have been experimenting with alternative means of organization and decision-making, grassroots democracy, decision-making at the level of a small group. There's been a great deal of useful theorizing about this among anarchist philosophers, how relatively large political units, perhaps not the size of the U.S., can be built up through direct delegate democracy, which involves real face-to-face decision-making and allows much less room for power politics.
Any particular individuals or books along that line you'd care to recommend?
Kirkpatrick Sale wrote a book on human scale that was very good in that regard. Oddly enough, there is one book that's very difficult to find. It's called The Green Book, and it's by Muammar Gaddafi, of all people. And while I've never been to Libya, I have no idea if his theories have actually been put into practice there. In The Green Book, he actually describes the process of direct delegate democracy, and it's actually a very forward-thinking philosophy that he describes in this little book. I can't help wondering, reading it, whether his advocacy of direct democracy is one of the reasons that he's been labeled as such a pariah in the international community, particularly by the U.S., but that's a matter of speculation. All I know is what he wrote.
And he doesn't seem to stand for election very often, so we have to wonder whether he's practicing what he preaches.
I would be interested sometime in taking a visit over there to find out if in fact he practices what he preaches. I understand he drives around Tripoli in an old Volkswagen Bug, which is kind of encouraging, instead of the giant Mercedes limousine or something.
I don't know. I guess I get amazed by this, because really what we're saying is a totally fundamental change in the way we perceive everything.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking a few minutes ago when you were talking about, you know, making string out of natural fibers, about a documentary I saw many years ago about a tribe in East Africa, and I do not know their names,
mm-hmm.
where in that culture the women build the house.
Right.
Physically, they are the architects and the construction engineers, and it's woman's work to build the house. The tribe has a certain set design that they use. They individualize it by putting clan markings and designs on the outside, but the basic structure is the same throughout the tribe. And in that tribe, no one is homeless, because everyone is either a woman who knows how to build or a man related to a woman who knows how to build.
Right.
And on one level, that's great, and on the other level, we have been able to develop specialization of interests and of labor, because we don't all take the time to build our houses.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it just seems to be rethinking time, rethinking
right.
what we do,
and rethinking how big a house we need.
Yeah.
Yeah. If we each had to build our own 2,000 square foot house, that would keep us busy for probably 10 or 15 years.
It seems to me that the single-family house is maybe a waste of space
right.
somewhere. Because, I mean, I'm an apartment rat. Lived in one all my life. My grandparents had a single house with a yard. But maybe the answer is tighter building, but with community land access?
Right, right. Yeah, we desperately need land reform in this country and around the world. And it sort of brings us